Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. Good morning, everybody. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will be in New York City next week for the annual gathering of the United Nations General Assembly, and his visit is once again focusing attention on Iran's imprisonment of two American hikers on charges of spying. Josh Fatal and Shane Bauer have been in detention since July 2009, when authorities found them and American Sarah Shourd hiking near the Iranian border. Last year at this time, right before the General Assembly, President Ahmadinejad grabbed the spotlight by arranging for Shourd's release on $500,000 bail. But a similar attempt this year to make a grand humanitarian gesture was thwarted earlier this week by the conservative members of Iran's judiciary, revealing ongoing internal struggles between Ahmadinejad and Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. A long weekend lies ahead for the hikers, whose attorney has filed a request for bail with the courts. Will it be granted? Or has Ahmadinejad's standing so deteriorated that the courts will reject the request and keep Fatal and Bauer in prison for the 8 years they've been sentenced to? Joining us is Karim Saljapour, an associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome back to WNYC, Karim.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
What has happened in the past year that allowed Ahmadinejad to trumpet Sarah Shourd's bail release but is keeping him from doing the same with Fatal and Bauer?
Well, what's happened in the last year, as you alluded to earlier on, is that President Ahmadinejad has had a falling out with the real power in Iran, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And I think that, you know, this was somehow bound to happen, in that Khamenei was really using Ahmadinejad as kind of a bludgeon against his domestic opponents. And now that he truly has become more powerful than he's ever been in his 22-year reign as Supreme Leader, Ahmadinejad becomes somewhat dispensable. I've described Ahmadinejad as Khamenei's dispensable sword. And at the same time, Ahmadinejad is not someone who is content merely playing second fiddle. I think, as we've seen over the last 6-7 years, the world has seen, he's someone with tremendous delusions of grandeur. Mm-hmm. And he loves, so this is, I think, his mecca, coming to New York every year and having all the world's media on his attention. And I think the fact that he hasn't been able to release these two young men yet shows, in a way, how emasculated he's been over the last year or so in Iranian politics.
And why has his standing so deteriorated? Why doesn't the Ayatollah need him anymore? What was he, he backed Ahmadinejad in 2005 for the presidency. He also stepped in 2009 when a protest movement erupted against Ahmadinejad's reelection, and he supported a backlash against the Green Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei did. So what went wrong? What is it that Ahmadinejad did to get his ally so mad at him?
Well, as I mentioned, I think that the people around Ayatollah Khamenei and Ayatollah Khamenei himself realized that Ahmadinejad was no longer content simply playing the role of the trusted lieutenant of the supreme leader. They kind of recognized that Ahmadinejad and his cohorts had greater ambitions, had greater designs for power in Iran. And one of the interesting things I learned was that Ahmadinejad's chief advisor, his Karl Rove, if you will, is a guy called Rahim Mashoi. And Rahim Mashoi, among other things, in private meetings, was alluding to people that they had, you know, greater designs for power in Iran, and they were interested in kind of eclipsing the clergy, the role of the clergy in Iran. Ahmadinejad and Mashoi come more from a military background rather than a clerical background. And a lot of these meetings were actually being bugged by intelligence forces loyal to Ayatollah Khamenei. So a variety of things have happened over the last year or so. But what I would say about Ahmadinejad is that he has this uncanny ability to get under people's skin. I think that foreigners think that it's only foreign skin that he gets under, but in fact, he's managed to really alienate his opponents and even, you know, his former colleagues and allies within Iran. So I sometimes quip that if Ahmadinejad were to write a book about his presidency post facto, the title could be How to Lose Friends and Alienate People.
Remind us of Ayatollah Khamenei's role in Iran's government structure. How does he shape the judiciary and the parliament?
You know, the Middle East is filled with autocrats, dictators, monarchs, and Khamenei certainly belongs to that category. He doesn't wear a crown like the former Shah of Iran, but you know his turban, you can kind of see it as a crown, meaning he has really become, in the last several years or so, the most powerful Iranian official, going back probably to the late Shah of Iran. And the constitutional authority, the vast majority of the constitutional authority in Iran lies in the hands of the supreme leader. He controls the judiciary, he controls the media, he basically has free rein over the Iranian parliament. And most importantly, Khamenei is in charge of the military, the Revolutionary Guards. He appoints their top leaders. And that's what we've also seen. That's one of the other trend lines in Iranian politics over the last decade or two, is the fact that, you know, despite the fact that the regime in Iran is sometimes referred to as a clerical regime, a regime run by holy men, by clerics, the Revolutionary Guards, this kind of elite military institution of 125,000 men or so, have really eclipsed the clergy in terms of their political influence and, most importantly, their economic influence. They have vast economic and political power within Iran. And Khamenei, by virtue of the fact that he is their commander-in-chief, has managed to really wield tremendous authority in Iran.
So it would seem like it doesn't behoove President Ahmadinejad to have these delusions of grandeur. It seems like he's nothing without the support of Ayatollah Khamenei, and yet he gets under his skin, as you mentioned. Who are Ahmadinejad's supporters? Where are they in this public spat?
Well, it's a very perceptive question, and the answer is somewhat nebulous, in that, you know, Ahmadinejad, it's oftentimes difficult to know how much popular support Ahmadinejad would have absent the backing of people like Khamenei and kind of the conservative establishment. What we know is that when Ahmadinejad, President Ahmadinejad has visited the provinces more than any president in the 32-year history of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And certainly does have these constituents which come from lower income brackets, which are the for lack of a better term, to make a generalization, the pious poor, you know, those who are from lower income brackets come from religious backgrounds, traditional backgrounds. But even then, it's not precisely clear if the state media starts to heavily criticize Ahmadinejad, if the supreme leader begins to heavily criticize Ahmadinejad, which he hasn't really done. Usually Khamenei is someone who likes to let others wage his wars. It's tough to put a precise number on it, but I would be surprised if Ahmadinejad has more than, say, 10-15% popular support.
I'm speaking with Karim Saljapour, an associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, on the current situation in Iran on the eve of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's visit to New York City for the annual UN General Assembly, and the fate of two American hikers who remain imprisoned in Iran on charges of espionage. Karim, an attorney for the two hikers, says he submitted a request for bail for the conservative courts to consider. I understand this is being mediated, this bail, between the Swiss embassy on behalf of the U.S. and Pakistan, which is representing Iran. Pakistani Prime Minister Yousaf Raza Gilani has been in Iran all week. Has the United States' recent diplomatic spats with Pakistan over such things as the raid to kill Osama bin Laden complicating matters here?
You know, my assessment, Amy, is that the key interlocutor here is actually not Pakistan, but it's Oman, particularly the Sultan of Oman, Sultan Qaboos. And Sultan Qaboos was really instrumental in winning the release of Sarah Shord, the female hiker who was released this time last year. It was Sultan Qaboos who sent his private plane to pick up Sarah Shord. It's widely thought that the Omanis paid the $500,000 bail money. And this time around, I've heard from several journalists who are now in Oman waiting for the release of these two young men, saying that the Omanis are also playing an instrumental role this time around. And Oman is interesting because Oman is kind of the equivalent of this very quiet diplomat who studiously does his or her job, but is not out for headlines. So, you know, Omanis are not flashy like some of their neighbors, like Dubai, for example. They're not out to win media headlines like Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey. But they have played the role of an effective interlocutor between the United States and Iran throughout the last three decades. They have pretty good relations with both Washington and Tehran. And in this particular instance, the case of these hikers, I would say that the Omanis have really played an instrumental role.
And this moving on the Associated Press wires, mediators from Iraq and Oman are asking Iran to release the two Americans convicted of spying. Omani officials say a plane from Oman is in Iran's capital to carry the pair out of the country if a bail for freedom deal is reached. The official spoke on condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the issue. Iraqi Foreign Minister Hoshyar Zebari says his country's leaders have urged Iran to release the Americans on humanitarian grounds. And he says, quote, everybody is now waiting for the next Iranian move to put an end to this issue. What is that next Iranian move, Karim Sajapour? What will you be looking for, signaling either a release of the two Americans or their continued imprisonment?
Well, this is very simple, Amy. If the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei snaps his fingers, these two young men could be released. I mean, they could have been released 2 years ago. And what's really sad is that these two young men have lost 2 years of their lives as political footballs. Both kind of political footballs in the U.S.-Iran Cold War and in Iran's internal political battles. And I think at the moment, what this has more to do with is Iran's internal political battles. As you mentioned earlier, these conservatives, the hardliners, hardline conservatives in Iran, really have their knives out for President Ahmadinejad, and they don't want to see him win points for winning the release of these young men. So they're trying to humiliate him. And it's the real calculations in the end, the real decision in the end will be made by the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. And it's kind of difficult to assess what his calculations are going to be. On one hand, I think that he's liked the fact that Ahmadinejad has been put in his place over the last several months. On the other hand, Khamenei has a very interesting ruling style, and that is that he has this philosophy in which he likes to wield power without accountability. Mm-hmm. And I think it's useful for Khamenei to have a president like Ahmadinejad, who is such a lightning rod for criticism, who loves the attention, because in a way it deflects responsibility and accountability away from Khamenei himself. But I think in order to retain that model of wielding power without accountability, it's not in Khamenei's interest to totally emasculate the president. I think it will be in Khamenei's interest to have the world think that Ahmadinejad still does have some power, and the accountability which should go along with that power. So my sense is that it's not in Khamenei's interest to see this drama go on for a long time. But again, when these two young men were first imprisoned 2 years ago, I really didn't anticipate this going on for more than a few months, and it's not been 2 years.
Right. And what is the message that Ayatollah Khamenei is trying to give to the United States? You talk about his humiliation of President Ahmadinejad, but these are two Americans he's dealing with. I would believe that there's other ways he can try and embarrass Ahmadinejad, like the showdown over control of the intelligence ministry, for example, a battle that Ahmadinejad recently lost. So what's Khamenei trying to say to the United States with this ongoing detention of these two Americans?
Well, I can tell you, throughout the last couple of years, when third countries have tried to mediate the release of these hikers, Iranian officials, including President Ahmadinejad, often intimated that they were interested in doing some type of a bartering deal in which Iranian nationals who are in American prisons for a variety of reasons, whether it's arms dealing or other kind of illicit military activities, if the U.S. would release these Iranian prisoners, the Iranians would agree to the release of these hikers. And I think the calculations of the White House and the State Department has always been that you don't trade in hostages, that when you begin to do that, you're essentially, quote-unquote, rewarding bad behavior. You're going to incentivize the Iranians to continue to employ hostage-taking as an element of their diplomacy, because they'll say, "Oh, okay, there's a reward for this. That we're winning the release of our people in American prisons." So, I think that was certainly probably in the back of Khamenei's head as well. That why should we have these with these hikers? And by the way, I think all the evidence points to the fact that these hikers, when they were snatched up by Iran, they were actually not in Iranian territory. There was an interesting investigative piece in The Nation magazine a year ago which showed they were actually in Iraqi Kurdistan. So they're in some ways they were really kind of kidnapped by Iranian revolutionary guards. But I'm sure that was a calculation of Ayatollah Khamenei, why should we give up these people for free when there are dozens of Iranian nationals in U.S. prisons?
In an interview you did this week, and I want to wrap up on this note, you did this on the BBC, you said Dubai, Turkey have built their economies by trading in goods and services while Iran remains in the business of human beings years after the 1979 hostage taking. What did you mean by that, the business of human beings? I mean, we're talking 500,000 here, 500,000 there. Is this really a part of their economic model, or what is this exactly that drives Iran to continue engaging in hostage taking?
Well, the point I made was that when you look at Iran's neighbors, Dubai and Turkey, and mind you, when you compare those places, Dubai and Turkey, to the Iran of 1978, they were really lagging behind. Dubai was kind of a desert backwater, and Turkey's per capita income was significantly lower than that of Iran. And what's transpired 30 years, 35 years later, is that Turkey's economy has taken off. Dubai has now become a household name. Dubai has really taken off. And their economies have thrived by trading in goods and services. And what I said is it's remarkable that the Islamic Republic of Iran, 32 years after the hostage crisis in which Iran took over the U.S. embassy and held American hostages for 444 days, Iran still remains in this business of trading in human beings. And what I mean by the business of trading in human beings is it's not an economic model. It's not that they're making vast sums of money on this, but that's what Iran is known for. Whereas kind of Dubai has come to be known as the region's trading hub, and Turkey has become a trading hub for the region, and also become an important political maneuver. The Islamic Republic of Iran has become to be known as the place in the Middle East where they take hostages. Mm. That's what they do.
Karim Saljapour is an associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Brian Lehrer Show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And stay tuned to WNYC. Of course, we will bring you details as they as they are revealed on what will happen to the fate of the two Americans imprisoned in Iran on the eve of the General Assembly, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, due in New York City next Monday. Coming up, we delve into the hidden world of self-injury and find out why it's becoming more mainstream. This is The Brian Lehrer Show on AM 820 and 93.9 FM WNYC. Stay tuned.